Roland Horn. I'm the Department of Petroleum Engineering Chairman. And I need to stress, in fact, the Horn Lecture is not named after me. My name is spelt with an E. It is, in fact, named after this gentleman, Professor Alva J. Horn, and actually his wife, Ruth. And A.J. Horn, as he was known to his friends, was a very prominent Stanford professor in the 1980s. And he instigated and taught for many years one of the most popular undergraduate classes at Stanford, PE 103, Introduction to the Energy Industry. So A.J. was much loved by his students, and when he retired in 1989, his students and fellows, friends and colleagues, instigated this Horn Lecture that you're now attending. So that's who A.J. was. So without going into more details than that, let me introduce you to tonight's speaker, Dr. John Grace. He has an interesting background that is as varied as it is wide, and he has had involvement in a number of different fields. He has a PhD in economics, and yet he has been an assistant professor of geology. And he, by happenstance, happens to have been learning Russian since age of 14, which has taken him to experience and activity in his career in Russia. He's also the author of a new book called The Russian Oil Supply, just published last year. So with that, let me introduce you please to Dr. John Grace.
Good evening, or dobry vecher. Let me change shows there. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you all this evening. I did not have the opportunity to know Professor Horn, but from what I know indirectly, he was an inspiring professor, an inspiring teacher, and I'm very much a product of where I got to by the intercession of some patient and inspirational professors I had when I was in school. I'm going to talk this evening about Russian oil supply. With the price of oil over $70, and Russia the second largest producer in the world and second largest exporter, I guess the topic is kind of timely. It's been one that I've been working on since I was in grad school myself, and my professor in geology said to me, well, gosh, you speak Russian, why don't you go work on West Siberia for a while? Which was kind of one step away from why don't we send you to West Siberia for a while. But it's been a fascinating thing to study even before it became so popular. When I first went to ARCO in 1985, after spending a year teaching before getting on to work in the industry, I told them that I'd done all this work on Russia when I was in graduate school, and they said, well, if I wanted to continue to do that, I had my nights and weekends available. But they really weren't interested in all. What I'm going to do tonight is take several different looks at the issue of Russian oil supply, and it may be a little disjoint because I'm going to talk a little bit about the geology of it and the economics and some of the history that precedes where we got to today. And the history really is pretty unusual. We'll start actually in a place which is no longer part of Russia. The Russian oil industry actually started in Baku, which is now in the independent nation of Azerbaijan. And Baku here is the pink area here. This is the Absheron Peninsula. And there's been seeps in production of oil in Baku since antiquity. It comes to the surface, and in big pits, people used to gather it in buckets. They used to gather it in rags. And they probably didn't produce more than tens or hundreds of barrels a day, mainly for potions, not even for illumination, but they were medicines and magical stuff, mostly in southbound trade. The Russians took over what is now Azerbaijan almost 200 years ago, and these oil seeps and fields around Baku, these fields out here in the Caspian Sea, and even these fields in southern Azerbaijan didn't exist at the time. This is all a product of Soviet work in the last century. But these accumulations here were very shallow. That's why you got the seeps at the surface, and it was a tectonically active environment that also led to it. The same sort of process that leads to the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles. So if you're down on Wilshire Boulevard and go to the Natural History Museum, you'll see the same sort of pits that people used to produce oil out of. After centuries of producing by traditional means, in the 1870s, the Tsar at that time passed some different legislation that allowed licensing for longer periods of time. It allowed foreigners to come in, and people started drilling wells rather than simply recovering oil from pits on the surface of the earth. They led to the discovery of a couple of large fields. In between the 1870s and the end of the century, Russia grew to be, as opposed to the United States, it was in competition with the larger producer of oil in the world. So by the time of the 1905 revolution in Russia, which foreshadowed the events of 1917 when the Tsar's dynasty came to an end, Russian production out of Baku was becoming increasingly central to the economy of Russia and also a major element in its foreign trade. But even though there was a lot of oil in the Absheron Peninsula around Baku, they were only accessing the very most shallow deposits. Even when they started drilling, they were using what were called cable tools, and they would drop this long metal pointed instrument down the hole and break some rocks and bring the rocks to the surface and then drop it again. It wasn't very efficient and they couldn't go very deep. So as the political events of the first part of the century disrupted Russia generally, they were also suffering at some level a certain depletion because they could only access the shallowest horizons. By the time of the revolution, because of the disruption, because of depletion of shallow deposits, the production of oil had started to decline, and World War II took a big bite out of it, and the Russian Revolution of 1917, the Civil War that followed, took even more. By the 1920s and 30s, they'd spread oil production into the North Caucasus around Chechnya, specifically the area that's been so troubled in the last 10, 15 years. But they also started exploring a brand new area. They went almost 2,000 kilometers to the northeast, to the Volga-Ural Basin. And these lights are a little bright for this image, but these are the Ural Mountains here. This is the Volga River here. This is the Kama River here. The area across here is about 1,500 kilometers, a very large basin. But the discoveries that were made in the 1930s were very small, apparently so small they're going to be hard for us to see on the screen. Yep, real hard for us to see on the screen. So hopefully this won't continue. But essentially you had a few discoveries down there, a few discoveries up here, and what the Soviets saw were very small fields, very far away from existing infrastructure, and really not much of economic interest. They were producing out of shallow horizons, drilling wells that were all less than 3,000 feet deep, and finding accumulations, but the oil wasn't particularly good, and they wasn't very high quantities. World War II changed things a lot. Germans, when they invaded in 1941, identified Baku and the fields in the North Caucasus as one of their main military objectives. And so the Soviet industry moved its entire efforts to the Volga-Ural Basin because even though there were only small deposits in the fields that aren't showing up here, they were deposits that were safe enough and distant enough from the fighting that the kind of effort that they needed to put into it, they would put into it. And it must be because of the projector. So this is going to be problematic. No, it isn't. I think it's the projector that's coming from the back. It's not allowing the stuff to be shown. Let me see if I'm going to have problems. Okay. So this field over here is one of the first big ones that was discovered, but while they were doing the work during the Second World War, they started to find out from a geologic point of view, same sort of problems, that there were two very, very large structural features, the South Tartar Arch and the Bashkir Arch up here, that were playing a fundamental role in concentrating the hydrocarbons. And The first discoveries that had been made in the basin were very shallow, but during World War II, they made an attempt to drill deeper. It had been predicted that there had been oil in the Devonian that was below the Carboniferous, and they had resisted drilling that deep for a number of technical reasons. But when they finally did, they found at Tumazinskoye, this field over here to the right, very, very large deposits, and that made them rethink their exploration strategy. Right here to the west of that by about 40 kilometers, there'd been a seismically identified prospect from the 1930s that people had basically blown off because it was too deep. But once they established oil at Tumazinskoye in the Devonian, they moved over here to Romashkino, and in 1947 they discovered not only the largest field in the basin, but what it was at that time, the largest field in the entire world. And that led off a blistering set of discoveries. These five fields here are the most important and the largest of them. And the projector is not going to allow me to show, unfortunately, what followed after that. Because of the discoveries in the Devonian, they realized the relationship between the thickness of the Devonian sandstone, which runs roughly like this, the thickness of a Devonian source rock, which runs roughly like this. Those were mapped on this before the projector got to it, and the large structural features that took that source rock, which was in its richest areas only 1% total organic carbon, and focused those hydrocarbons migrating into these large structural traps. We'll get back to that in a second, but with the permission of the machine, we'll go on and see if we can look a bit at the geology of West Siberia. West Siberia is 900 kilometers again to the east, again the Ural Mountains here. This is the Yenisei River, which forms the eastern margin of the West Siberian Basin. This is the Ob River that comes up in the middle. The West Siberian Basin is the largest flat land on Earth. The elevation of the basin here, a couple of thousand kilometers to the south of the Arctic Sea, is only 400 feet. And that creates a couple of things in terms of logistics of working in the basin. When spring comes to the southern part of the basin and the ice and snow starts to melt down here, starts to feed the tributaries of the Ob and the Tobol and the Irtysh, this area up here at the Ob Gulf is still frozen. So the water, which runs from south to north, backs up behind that ice plug, basically, at the end of the river, and as a result of the flatness of the basin, inundates the entire area. And what you would see, and unfortunately won't see, you will see, is that it had the same sort of general physiography all the way back in the Jurassic. In fact, it had been suggested by the guy who's recognized as the father of Soviet petroleum, a guy named Ivan Gubkin. He had suggested in the 1930s, after he'd been successful at predicting the occurrence of oil and gas in the Devonian and the Volga-Ural Basin, he said in a conference that was held in 32 that the coal-bearing facies that are exposed along the eastern flanks of the Ural Basin probably continued, the western flanks of the Ural Mountains continued to the east and would have been an excellent source rock in the West Siberian Basin itself. And in fact, what happened in the Jurassic time, this entire area was inundated by a relatively shallow sea. The entire combination of the European plate and the Siberian plate were several thousand kilometers to the south of their present rather chilly conditions. And as a result of that, that inland sea was an extremely productive biologic environment. And what I have mapped here is actually the percentage of total organic carbon that accumulated, with the highest percents in the center of the basis being 10 or more percent. While greater than 1% did the trick in the Volga-Urals basins, you now had an order of magnitude more organic matter, or the stuff that goes into making oil and gas, that accumulated in this contiguous area within West Siberia. So that made it an excellent place for the generation of hydrocarbons, and after the deposition of the Bezhenov Shale at the end of the Jurassic, the basin started to become more terrestrial, the sea retreated, and there was a coastline that ran roughly north-south and river systems that came off the highs of the East Siberian Plate, fed sands and then shales as well into the basin here, covering, burying the Bezhenov Shale and starting the process of maturation of that organic matter and also forming the reservoirs that ultimately became part the major part of the West Siberian oil and gas system. At the same time, the plates that had formed, East European plate, when it collided with the Siberian plate, that happened in late Permian and Jurassic when the Ural Mountains were raised over here on the west, formed some of these highlands here on the east of the Yenisei River, but also put the basin into compression so that you have large-scale compressional features that exist in the subsurface throughout the basin. This made an incredible confluence of all the right elements that you want for an oil and gas system, one of world-class size and quality. So what we had was the generation of oil and gas, which was kind of proportional to the total organic carbon. We had the reservoir feces that were coming down here through the central part of the basin that had been shed off by erosion from the highlands of East Siberia. And we had these compressional features in the subsurface that, like the compressional features in the Volga-Ural basins, focused the migration of hydrocarbons that were generated across a large area and then put them into very, very small areas associated with these uplifts. So that made it really kind of the perfect place for oil and gas to exist, but it wasn't until the 1960s, almost 30 years after Gubkin made his forecast that West Siberia would be a good place to look, did you get the actual exploration for oil and gas in the basin. And we're just going to see right now if the projector will be friendly with our fields, and it is. These three fields here, Samotlor, Fedorova, Mamontova, you see that they're right in the center of where that TOC, total organic carbon, high was. They're actually located on or on the flanks of these major positive features in the basin. And these three fields themselves, which were found in the very early part of exploration, are really the fundamental core. They anchor production in the basin. If the Soviets had not been able to find fields this size early on, West Siberian oil and gas might have remained in the ground, because the same amount of oil and gas distributed over a large number of very small fields would not have afforded them the economies of scale in exploration and production that allowed them to develop the basin in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. After the discovery of the first few fields, these three giant fields, the first generation, they found the same sort of keys that they found in the Volga-Ural exploration. In this case, they looked for fields that were, with the exception of this one on the left, the west side, which is deeper, they were associated with the structural highs, they were in the center of the area where the maximum generation of oil was, and they were also associated with the thick that occurred in the Neocomian of the reservoir facies that hold the oil and gas that was generated. So after picking off the very largest fields in the basin, they then picked off a second generation of about a dozen fields that really did form the core, as you'll see in a minute, of what was produced and is still produced. After, and this is kind of the last attempt, after the generation that was the second generation of discoveries, they found roughly 400 more fields in the basin. And while there are very large gas fields to the north of this, up here basically, these oil fields are all basically trapped under the same geologic conditions as these supergiant fields that were discovered originally. The oil's coming out of the Bezhenov Upper Jurassic Shale. It's being reservoired in Neocomian reservoirs that are usually multiple reservoirs, 10, 15, 20, hundreds of reservoirs, 200 reservoirs in the case of Samotlor, what the Russians call shashlik, or shish kebab, because you got a well going down and then you got a little reservoir and you got a little piece of vegetable there, which is a shale, and you know, you don't like the vegetables, so you go down to the next little piece of meat, and that's the way these wells look when you look at them in cross-section on well logs. Pay, shale, pay, shale, pay, shale. And it is a good thing, even though the Soviets concentrated mainly on producing the largest reservoirs, because some of those reservoirs were untouched by Soviet production practices, and that's a lot of the potential that remains. So I'm going to move out of map space, if that's okay, and get that scary picture off. And let me move to something which will probably be a little more technologically friendly. PowerPoint. I also want to back up because I want to put the geologic stuff in the kind of context of the technologies of exploration and production. And here again, I've backed up to the Volga-Ural Basin. This is the South Tartar Arch, which you couldn't see because we couldn't project it. This is the Bashkir Arch. And these are those five big fields that had been found early in exploration, Ramashkino, one to its immediate west, Arlon. And then they found several hundred more fields, again relying basically on the same geologic ideas. In this case, they were Devonian sources, Devonian reservoirs, and these big structural uplifts. But oil and gas fields all over the world, and my career has basically been in an area called resource assessment, looking at the assessment of undiscovered oil and gas in large areas, from plays to basins. What we see again and again is what's called the log normality, the distribution of discovered accumulations. That is, there's a very large amount of oil which is concentrated in a very small number of extremely large fields. And then there is a relatively small amount of oil that's distributed among a very large number of very small fields. Well, that's good and that's bad. It's good because the area of the fields is also log normally distributed. So if you were even to drill randomly against a set of targets that are log normally distributed, if you were just shooting darts at the board against log normally distributed targets, you would hit the largest targets first just by random drilling. But when you put the science of exploration behind it, you tend to discover the very largest fields very early in the exploration cycle. And that's exactly what happened in the West, in the Volga-Ural Basin. This is an axis of field size, and note, most importantly, that this is a logarithmic axis. This is an axis of time, and these three regression lines, even though there's wide variance around them, show you that we discovered, or the Soviets discovered, the very largest fields very early on, and then the size of discoveries declined exponentially over time. In fact, in the Volga-Ural Basin, as well as in the West Siberian Basin, the size of new discoveries over the history of its exploration has declined by roughly half every 8 years. So that's a big drop. And that's the downside, that's the flip side of the coin that allows you to discover the big base, the big fields early. You've discovered the big fields early, but and that's great. But then you're condemned to face an exponentially declining exploration efficiency in terms of the effort that you put into it, and that's certainly what happened in the Volga-Urals. The second implication of log normality of fields is because the largest fields are found early, and because in petroleum economics there is no more important factor than economies of scale, people produce the largest fields first because they enjoy the economies of scale that they can't get if the same amount of oil is distributed over a smaller number, a large number of smaller fields. And so what you get out is you get an incredible run-up in production that comes from these very largest fields. And in fact, of the 400 some odd producing fields in the Volga-Ural Basin, here up through the point where my pointer is, these first five fields are five fields out of 400. And then this next section here is the largest set that came after that, and this set here. But these fields here, there are only about 80 fields in this cohort, and there are several hundred fields in this cohort. So when you produce those fields out, just as you're facing exponential decline in discovery efficiency because of the log normality of fields, as the largest fields are producing, you face an inevitable drop in the production that you get from the basin as a whole. And in fact, that is exactly what has happened in the case of the Volga-Ural Basin, and I'll talk about that little uptick in just a moment. The same phenomenon can be seen in West Siberia. West Siberia is the richest gas basin in the planet, and it's the second richest oil basin in the planet. But just like even smaller and less propitious places to look for oil and gas, it suffers the same sort of log normality, or enjoys or suffers, depending on your point of view, the same sort of log normality and distribution of field size. And while there's a very wide variance around the regression line, the line unquestionably declines exponentially. And so we see in map view what we saw a few minutes ago, these being the very largest fields that were found very early on, and these green fields being the other fields are the hundreds of fields that populate down in the 10 to 100 million barrel to sub 10 million barrel range. And when you're dealing with West Siberia, which is the world's largest Arctic swamp, the minimum economic field size to produce in Soviet times used to be a 50 million barrel field. They wouldn't complete a field that was less than 50 million barrels. For those of you in the audience who are not familiar with oil and gas on an intimate basis, a 50 million barrel field, boy, the last one that was discovered onshore U.S. was probably in the 80s. Offshore is a little bit different. But a 50 million barrel field is very large. But when you go to this kind of environment, you have such a large fixed cost that you have to overcome to even operate in that environment that you can't go unless you're enjoying those tremendous economies of scale that attend the production of the very largest fields. The same sort of story in the Volga Urals has been repeated in the West Siberian Basin, where this is production from Samut Lor, that first, the largest field, 25 billion barrels, that was discovered here in 1963. That's the black. Fedorova, this field right here, and Mamontova, the first three fields, this little guy here. That little guy there is about 10 billion barrels. Those three fields by themselves were responsible when the Soviet production peaked in the mid-80s, 1987-88, those three fields alone were responsible for roughly half of the production of the Soviet Union at a time when the Soviet Union was the largest producer of oil in the world. This purple area here is that second generation of fields that I talked about, a group of 14 fields, and the remaining 150 fields that produce in the basin are represented by these two areas here. So as a basin matures and the very largest fields are depleted, production gradually moves to smaller and smaller fields, and with an attendant increase in average cost in most situations. So that's the kind of production that production history and exploration history that West Siberia has enjoyed, and this kind of starts to put it in economic context. Again, on this axis here, field size, millions of barrels, very important to point out that this is a logarithmic axis. And what these bars show is this is the size of the largest field brought on that decade, the 1960s, the size of the mean field brought on to production, and the sizes of the smallest field. So not only has the mean declined in every successive decade to the point where it's roughly 15 to 20 times smaller now in 2000 than it was in the 1960s, very importantly, the smallest size that they're bringing on is now to the 1 to 10 million barrel range. A lot of those are fields that are close to existing infrastructure and can be economically produced. But this is the characteristic signature of a maturing oil basin, where you've moved out of the very largest fields that are dominant in the early phase, the smaller fields that become dominant in the exploration cycle then become dominant in the production cycle. And fortunately, as the infrastructure grows more dense, it's possible to produce smaller and smaller fields, because one of the problems that you have early on in the cycle is that these large fields are required to support the infrastructure. Once the infrastructure is already in place, you can move to progressively smaller fields, and that's certainly the story of the United States production. There are about 45,000 fields in the United States, and the average size of, or the median size of fields that produce in the United States is way, way down in this range. In fact, in the United States, we produce thousands of fields that have less than a million barrels in them. So that kind of sets both the exploration geologic context of Russian oil and gas, production that went from Baku in the century before last, during World War II, went to the Volga Ural Basin, and after the discovery of the geologic keys to how oil and gas was formed and how oil and gas was trapped in the Volga Ural Basin, exploration was quite efficient. Same with the production. They were efficient because they enjoyed very, very large fields. But as the Volga Ural Basin started to decline, fortunately for the Soviets, they were able to jump the Ural Mountains, go to the east, and even a larger basin awaited them there. So what you see, if you look at the history of Soviet and then Russian production from the end of World War II through the present, is you see an incredible ramp up in production that was fueled first by the Volga Urals production. And without Volga Urals production, the economic recovery that occurred in the Soviet Union after the Second World War probably would have died with Stalin in the early 50s. But because of their access to cheap fuel that came out of Volga Urals production, they were not only able to fuel the economic recovery that occurred, that kept the growth rate, the macroeconomic growth rate, going at 5, 6, 7%, but every decade after the late 40s into the 50s and 60s and 70s, macroeconomic growth rate declined and declined and declined. Yet at that time, as things were going down in the 1970s and they moved over, the West Siberian Basin gave them a new lease on life. I personally think that the Soviet Union probably lasted for a decade or more, longer than it did, or would have lasted less than a decade, it would have ended a decade earlier, if these oil and gas resources hadn't been available to the Soviets. Because the oil and gas that was available from these basins, especially in the early part of their production, when they had such big fields, was so cheap that it was able to fuel an otherwise very inefficient economy and give them productivity that they just wouldn't have gotten otherwise. Moreover, the Soviets used it in their imperial capacity to bind the economies of Eastern Europe, first to the Volga Urals oil, then to West Siberian oil, finally to West Siberian gas. It's creating problems that those now independent nations are still wrestling with today, because such an important commodity, their energy resources, is still dominantly coming from a neighbor with whom they don't always have particularly good relations. The Soviets saw by the mid-1980s as production as an end in itself. Knowing that they were so macroeconomically dependent on these resources, the industry and the government made a Faustian bargain in the 1970s, and the oil and gas guys in West Siberia said to the apparatchiki in Moscow, you shovel more money to us every single year, we're going to send more oil and gas back to you. And originally the system worked. The Soviets were able to extract a lot of rent from their resources. But as time went on and they moved to smaller fields and water cuts went up and flow rates went down, the flow of advantage changed. And even though the Soviet government kept on shipping more and more oil, more and more money out to West Siberia, every year they shipped less and less increase of oil and gas back to the guys in Moscow. In 1976, when the budget for oil and gas operations in West Siberia went up by 6%, oil and gas production went up by 6%. But by the time production peaked in the 1980s, growth in budgets was still 6% a year, and the amount that they were giving back was less than 1% a year in growth. So very few cases in any sort of economics, certainly in natural resource economics, do you see a more profound example of diminishing returns to investment than occurred in West Siberia and in the Soviet Union generally in the 80s. More and more money in, less oil out. It's not a sustainable dynamic. And by the mid-1980s, it got to the point where it just couldn't be sustained. And so as the peak in 1987 and 1988 was realized, I think most of the men at the top, at least in the oil and gas and geologic ministries in Moscow, knew that the end was coming. And as the Soviet Union started to break apart in 1989 and 1990, even before its official end at the end of 1991, money that was going to the industry started to collapse as well, and production started to go with it. Now, this graph looks a little more profound than it was in fact, because the USSR outside of Russia produced 1 million barrels a day. But what happened was an incredible collapse, the likes of which have never been seen in the world industry at any time in the 150, 160 years we've been producing oil and gas as an industrial commodity. Never seen the kind of drop of half of the production of a major part of the world resource base in the space of 6 or 7 years. But that's exactly what happened. And what we can see here, moving from the technology and geology of it to the economics, in 1991 in December, Soviet Union gave up the ghost, the Russian Federation became an independent country, as did the other 14 Union republics of the USSR. And we pick up the story in 1993, after production, if you read the purple line off of this graph, had already fallen in the Russian Republic from over 11.4 million barrels a day in its peak year of 1988, so by the time we pick up the story in 1993, it's just over 7 million barrels a day. So they've lost already 4 million barrels a day in the space of about 5 years. But here what we see is basically the economic cause of the collapse and then the economic cause of the recovery. Here, at the top of each one of these bars is the price of oil in Russia. And that price of oil is a combination of both the domestic price, which was very, very heavily controlled by Soviet-era price controls, and then the export price on the world market. And then if we subtract off of that the cost that it was incurred to produce the oil, and then the red part of the bar is the cost that was incurred to transport the oil from the fields to either the refineries domestically or to export points. The red part is the excise tax, and the blue part is the tariff required for transportation. If you start at an oil price that's here around $12 a barrel, subtract operating costs, subtract taxes, and subtract tariffs, basically by the beginning of the Russian Republic, they were losing oil, they were losing money to the tune of roughly $5 on every single barrel that they produced. And it's no surprise, therefore, that production continued to fall and finally bottomed out around 6 million barrels a day, or just over half of what it had been at the peak. Prices started to recover, tariffs were pulled back a little bit, excise taxes were pulled back a little bit, and we got a stable bottom here. They started drilling wells, they started fixing wells, but what really happened that was the major turning point happened in 1998. 1997, if you went to Russia that time in order to get an official exchange rate, you exchanged 6 rubles to the dollar. And in August of 1998, Russia unpegged the ruble, let it float, and it devalued by a factor of 6, so that it cost 30 rubles to get a single U.S. dollar after devaluation. The effect that that had was profound, because for every single dollar that they got in exports, they could now pay for much more taxes, much more tariffs, much more operating costs. So denominated in dollars, you can see that operating costs, taxes, and tariffs changed radically, shrinking from what they had been in early 98 to 1999. And for the first time since the collapse of production, they actually were making a profit on oil production in Russia in 1999. The second thing that happened was the increase in prices that started in late 1999 and has increased to what we know today is $70 a barrel. But at this time here, 1998 and early 1999, oil was $10 a barrel. And so with the reduction in costs associated with the devaluation and the increase in revenues associated with the increase in world prices and some continued deregulation of domestic prices, they were able to make profits regularly through the early part of this decade on oil and gas, and that is what has fueled a 50% increase in reduction in production since 1998 through last year. 50%. It's gone up not quite as fast as it fell, but it's gone up at a remarkable rate. But it's now starting to plateau off, and I'll get back to that in a second. But what the Russians have basically done at a policy level is, while the tariff side has been relatively constant and the operating cost side has been relatively constant, the government has decided that they're going to tax oil and recuperate a lot of that stuff that was lost in the 1990s when oil was privatized. So while the price of oil today on both the domestic and foreign markets is very high, the Russians have set up a taxation system in order to remove a very large part of what would be called a windfall to producers if it was allowed to pass through to them. And so the amount that's available back at the wellhead, while much higher than it was, is not going up proportional to the amount of increase in world prices. I'm going to spend a few minutes now talking a little bit about the politics of what happened, because it's as much a part of the outlook for Russian supply as is the geology that constrains the production possibilities and the technology that enables production to occur. And that political story starts with Boris Yeltsin. And Boris Yeltsin was the one who succeeded Gorbachev after the end of the Soviet era. And while we think of the Soviet structure, and we think of the Russian structure that preceded it as being rather pyramidal, a historian from Harvard, a guy named Edward Keenan, has suggested, looking back over the sweep of Russian history, that a better model of Russian political authority is not a pyramid, but the model of an atom. And it's with the czar or the commissar or the president as the center of that atom, and little shells around him forming what is a much more collegial form of government than we would not normally associate with Soviet structures or Russian structures or Tsarist structures. And so around Boris Yeltsin, very early on, he brought in oil guys. His prime minister on and off several times, Viktor Chernomyrdin, came from Gazprom. His energy minister, not surprisingly, Yuri Shafranek, came from one of the oil-producing associations from the old Soviet Union. But what happened in the mid-90s was that a second shell formed in this particular atom, and that was surrounded by, on this side of the shell, men who had succeeded in making the transition from being the general manager of Soviet-era production organizations to being the president of newly privatized companies. These guys, Alek Perov and Lukoil, Bogdanov and Surgut Neftegaz. But even more interesting was these guys and those like them, the oligarchs, financial sharpies and insiders who came up through the late 80s and early 90s making their livings on street-level capitalism and crime and whatever paid in that rather wild period of time. These guys got close enough that in the mid-90s, when Russia was in macroeconomic distress, they managed to get hold of a very large share of the oil and gas resources of the former Soviet Union. The patrimony that Russia had inherited from the Soviet Union was then turned around and dealt to these guys on the outside of the industry and these guys on the inside of the industry, literally for pennies per barrel. This guy, Yukos's chairman, former chairman, now in jail, Khodorkovsky, bought Yukos's assets for roughly 6 cents per barrel. This guy paid around 4 cents per barrel. At a time when the world price of oil was $17, $19, $20 a barrel, and even the price of so-called in-ground resources was roughly $6 a barrel. They were getting it for literally pennies a barrel. And it was this kind of structure where these guys passed in and out of government and in and out of their influence on government. These guys here financed this guy's election in 1996, and he won, and he wouldn't have otherwise, and he owed them. And so that kind of unsavory reciprocity was really central to what was, in a sense, a collegial way to run the country. Not a good way to run the country, but not exactly an autocratic way. Yeltsin was beholden to them because he was beholden to their financial support, and he therefore paid them off in the kind of terms that they came to expect. Well, what happened as a result in the industry, if we start in 1991, where all production was based on state enterprises, as Yeltsin's administration went on, you got the first major oil company, that was Lukoil, and more major oil companies, more major oil companies. Finally, you got independent oil companies and joint ventures, organizations and structures that would never have been contemplated in the Soviet period, but were possible now. And so by the time of the mid-90s, when the loans for shares and the so-called privatization went on, the amount that the state was producing of total Russian oil was tiny. It had been not necessarily privatized, but it had been denationalized. The industry had been moved off of the state budget, and that was a critical difference between the Soviet model and the model that followed. It wasn't so much that they were private stockholders in these companies, it was the fact that they had to get their revenues from market sales as opposed from government allocations. And that created a lot of the pain of the transition that went on in the 1990s. Well, by the end of the 1990s, in 1999, as a present to everyone, I guess, though he deserves a lot of credit for bringing Russia through the transition from the Soviet Union to the post-Soviet period, Yeltsin's health and Yeltsin's drinking got the best of him, and fortunately he or those around him decided he really had to go, and he did. He went quietly, he went peacefully, and the succession was passed to the man who runs Russia today, Vladimir Putin. And Putin, in the first part of his tenure in 2000 and 2001, took very strong action against some of those oligarchs who had made out so well in the Yeltsin period. Not all of them, some of them. And the ones that he took most decisive action against were the ones who were challenging him politically. And so some of those he ran off, some of them he threatened with jail. This is even before Khodorkovsky and the Yukos started. And he started to build his own circle, that first electron shell around the nucleus, and he's filled it with people, kind of interestingly, that are even more exchanging positions in shells. This guy here who runs Rosneft, the state oil company, is actually the chief of staff of the Russian administration, equivalent to Andrew Card or the guy who just replaced him in the White House. This guy here, Medvedev, also a deputy chief administrator of the Russian government administration, but at the same time the chairman of Rosneft and chairman or the deputy chairman of Gazprom. This guy runs Transneftproduct, which is the main products pipeline company, and also at the same time part of the administration. But there's still a circle outside. There's still some of the old red directors like Bogdanov in Sirgut Neftegaz. Bogdanov runs a big oil company, but happened to have been Putin's campaign manager in West Siberia when he ran for re-election. So moving into government, moving out of government, this guy here is known as the chemical oligarch, this guy Kantor. He's certainly a very important figure in the industry of Russia, but he's been deputized pretty much by Putin to go help the folks over in the Ukraine understand that their transitions maybe shouldn't be as radical as some are proposed. This guy here, this guy Gutseriev, Rusneft, it's a fairly small distinction in vowels, is now the new up-and-coming private oil company in Russia. Its increase in production has been tremendous in the last few years. A man also fairly close to Yeltsin, comes from the southern part of Russia in the area of the Caucasus, and after the tragedy a year or so ago at Beslan in Ingushetia, it's been Gutseriev who's been sent by Putin down there to try and calm the waters and be an unofficial emissary. So he's got one oligarch running off to the Ukraine, he's got another oligarch who are not official members of the government running down to the Caucasus, but at the same time he has official members of the government who've been injected into the private, so-called private sector, and the increasing state oil and gas presence. And finally, I had to put this in here. I looked on the internet and I found a traditional picture of a boyar. What a boyar was in medieval times were these people who are the heads of clans who sat as retinues of the Tsar. And they weren't part of the royal family and they weren't really outside of control, but they moved back and forth and back and forth doing the bidding, being the eyes and ears of the Tsar. And these boyars, this must be one before Peter the Great because Peter made them shave their beards. These kind of, I think, are a much better model of the role that these people are playing in the Russian industry and in the Russian government, as especially it becomes more and more centralized relative to what it was in the Yeltsin administration. So these guys, you might call them boyars, you might call them bureaugarchs, because they're bureaucrats and they're oligarchs at the same time, but what they are definitely not is people who operate recognizing a distinction between service and government and service and private industry. There's a very, very diaphanous membrane that exists between these two spheres in Russia, and it's one where there's a lot of exchange between the two sides of the membrane. Putin has enjoyed, unlike Yeltsin, and unlike Gorbachev for that matter before him, Putin has enjoyed a period of rising prices. And Putin has enjoyed a period of rising production. And for the first few years of his administration, he really didn't do much to upset the fraction of production that is produced by the state organs. There were still major, it was dominated by about a half a dozen, eight major oil companies, which were largely private, and then a small independent sector and foreign investment sector that is represented here at the top. But then a couple of years ago, as part of the more nationalist plan that he was pursuing on a political level, eliminating political opposition, centralizing political control of what had been previously local government administration to the federal level, he started actively moving, injecting the two state organizations, Rosneft on the Russian, on the oil side, Gazprom on the gas side, injecting them much more obviously into the management of companies and getting them in as partners and joint ventures. And as a result of that, they started to take a little bit larger position, you can see here, by acquiring some of these independent companies that have been around. But then when Yukos was dissolved as a result of the government's prosecution, as well as persecution, of the management of Yukos, and the management of Yukos, just to take a second to mention it, and the management of Yukos certainly started with an enterprise which by any of our Western standards would be described as criminal. But if the Russian government were to go back in this decade and prosecute everyone from the last decade who was involved in the type of frauds that Yukos was involved in, they'd have to reopen the gulag because it was everybody. What Yukos did wrong and what Khodorkovsky did wrong was not the offenses they committed against the criminal code and the tax codes. It was the political opposition that they were raising to Putin And they used that as an opportunity, knowing that he had a dirty past, to shut him down because he was a threat to the regime. Not because they were trying to clean up generally, because if they were trying to clean up generally, there wouldn't be anyone around at the upper level of all the oil companies in the country. They wouldn't have anyone to run the pumps anymore. But the one who stood up and started opposing the regime was dealt with the same way Putin dealt with some earlier oligarchs, not so much related to oil, when he first came into office. He basically made the deal with them in the early part of 2000 when he came to office and said, if you guys stay out of politics, you guys can keep the money you made last decade. And a couple of them kind of didn't, and Khodorkovsky, even though the path he took was a shallower path, finally he himself rose to the point of a clear threat to the Putin regime. He was a guy with infinitely deep pockets and willing to finance his opposition, and the Putin administration certainly wasn't going to allow that, and he is now in a jail in the very far eastern part of the country. So when Yukos was dissolved, rather than letting the assets of Yukos flow to the private sector, it was Rosneft that took it over. And Rosneft has been touting itself as a great producer. It's been touting itself as one who can increase production and increase reserves. But Rosneft has increased its reserves and increased its production over this decade because it has bought those production and has bought that reserves. It isn't because they're good managers of legacy assets. They've acquired them, and in most cases acquired them by the power of state muscle being behind them. So they were able to get the Yukos main asset called Yugansk-Neftegaz. And then this year, if we take this as an estimate of 2006 production, Gazprom, which was supposed to merge with Rosneft last year, took what was probably the most nimble and aggressively, technologically aggressive company called Sibneft, and it bought Sibneft. So the assets of Yukos go into Rosneft, a state structure. The assets of Sibneft goes to Gazprom, the gas giant, a state structure. And what we have here is an increase in production under direct state control, which is many times greater than it was since 1995. And what's more, they aren't done. Assets that are held by the joint venture company TNK-BP, called Slavneft, some of their own Russian partners. The TNK-BP is a 50-50 deal between Russia, the Russian investors in TNK, and the British company BP. Those Russian assets, the Russian side of that partnership, are also a target of Gazprom and Rosneft. And so there are several of the companies that had formerly belonged to this green cohort of relatively independent majors, putatively private firms, that are now being moved progressively into direct state control. So what we've seen now is a renationalization of much of the asset base that was lost in the denationalization that occurred under Yeltsin. So that brings us to a question of what's that going to mean for supply? This is the rate of production, a three-month moving average, monthly rate of production from 1999 through the beginning of 2006. And it shows a steady increase in that entire time. But never be satisfied with just the first derivative. You always got to go to the second derivative. And this is the rate of growth in that curve over that period. And what you can see is while production continues to increase, it has been for the last 2.5 years increasing at a declining rate, so that we're seeing what is probably a plateau. It could be a respite. It could be just catching its breath after 7 years of really remarkable growth. But it's much more likely, given the geologic constraints on the resource base, the impact of the log normal distribution of oil and gas deposits, the types of reservoirs and flow rates that they face in the Volga-Ural Basin and in West Siberia. It's probably going to be a place where, like the Soviets met in the mid-80s, there's a diminishing return to increasing investment in oil and gas exploration and production. Not that it's over, but that there's a diminishing return at the margin. And that's probably what we're seeing right here. So the questions that the title of my talk asked were Russian oil, state or market, and Russian oil up and down. And it seems up or down. It seems like the answer to the first question of state or market is a fairly simple one. Russia's views its natural resources as a central part of its strategy of macroeconomic development. And as a consequence of that, it really sees that as the core of their ability to move their economy forward this decade and the next. And as a result of that, they see that they're going to have to control, or believe they're going to have to control, those from the center, because that's the tradition. Markets, while they certainly have treated Russia well in many respects over the last 15 years, are seen by the Russian administration not as intrinsically good, but as tools in their economic set of tools which they can apply to further their general macroeconomic goals. So without a belief that markets are intrinsically good, they see them as having limited value and limited application, and not necessarily the only way to go. The state companies, moreover, are in a sense, if you buy this atomic theory of Russian political structure, they are the appanages or the fiefdoms to which the administration can give their loyal boyars or retainers. And so unless you've got that set of opportunities with which you can reward the people who are loyal to you, you've got a less leverage in order to keep their loyalty. Oil and gas are just too important for laissez-faire. They don't view it as the way to go, but a way to go if one has to go that way. There are people who believe that the national control of oil and gas resources at the management level is not at the expense of efficiency. But if you look at the technical operation of Rosneft and Gazprom, what you see is companies that are not technologically efficient. They are companies that have been technologically retarded relative to the progress that's been made by the private sector majors. So while some believe that it will not be at the cost of efficiency, there's no empirical evidence to support that hypothesis at all. And if they want to look to Western citation or the citation of the actions of other governments in restricting the role of foreign investment and protecting industries, all they have to do is look around the world, because the tendency is to increasingly restrict foreign investment and increase the role of states in deciding how economic decisions are made. Condoleezza Rice went to Russia a year ago and told the Russian government that they needed to make an equal playing field so foreign companies could come in there and make the same sort of investment that Russians could. And by last fall, when the Ministry of Energy, Khrushchenko, came to the United States, he thanked the United States for the object lesson that we'd given him in the case of Unocal and its possible acquisition by the Chinese National Oil Company. Or in the case of Dubai Ports World and their acquisition of port facilities. And the Russians say that they're learning at the American hands about the relationship that should exist in an ideal state between a private sector, foreign investment, and state control. So they don't need their own ideology to support some of these decisions. They can look around and see others are doing the same thing. There's also a very strong belief that Putin, when he came to office, had a mandate to reverse what were unquestionable excesses that occurred under the Yeltsin regime. They gave away the patrimony, the natural resource patrimony of that country in large measure to a tiny number of individuals who earned tens of billions of dollars because either they were in the right place at the right time or paid off the people who were. And that mandate to reverse is some of what you're seeing. Rather than simply expropriating it from those who got it and redistributing it in the market system, their response from these other political and cultural reasons is to bring it back into the state. So it's a heavily statist society. It's got very mixed support for markets. And if the question is state or market, the direction and momentum is clearly in favor of more state ownership. The question, the final question to address, is Russian production up or down? On the positive side, the resource base is gigantic. Russia has the largest proved reserves of oil outside of OPEC. According to the USGS's last good assessment in the mid-90s of world oil resources, they have the largest undiscovered resource base of technically recoverable oil in the world. So that gigantic resource base still can fuel substantial growth from new sources and better technology applied to old sources. High oil prices, the effect is self-evident. as long as some fraction of that money is flowing back to the wellhead, increasing oil prices and high sustained oil prices will give them the opportunities to make investments in the fields and exploration that will support increasing production. In the short run, there are several new multinational projects that are coming on board. Sakhalin is the most prominent of those, and that will give a short-run boost to production to offset some of the declines that's starting to occur in the very large fields again. And there's a strong corporate and political will, if not to grow, to prevent reduction, and that augurs in favor of higher production. But on the other side, you have growing state management and the inefficiency that comes with it, and that impact can't be overestimated. There is a heavy tax burden, and that's keeping some of the benefits of high oil prices from flowing back to producers who would make larger investments if they could, even though the elasticity of supply at this point is very low, and the marginal investment is going to return a fairly low marginal product as a result of it. The easy oil in Russia that was lost in the 1990s with the collapse of the industry has been largely recouped. They're not going to get more oil production on simply by replacing electrical submersible pumps and drilling better wells and doing better fracs. They've done the better fracs. They replaced the wells. And so now they have to look at production of resources that would have escaped an easier go-through in rehabilitation. And finally, there is an opposition not only to foreign investment, which they allow in strategic locations and less of it, but there's an opposition to the independent, that second tier of oil companies, which is central to supply and non-OPEC countries. And as long as they oppose that kind of foreign investment and the small projects that come on associated with small fields and small companies, there's the difference in decline that occurs after a peak, where if you've got a good, robust industry, the production falls at 1 or 2%, like it does in Alberta or it does in the Gulf Coast Basin, because you've got hundreds of small companies in there doing small projects that add up. But when it's dominated by these very large state-run actors, they're much more likely to look after the peak occurs at production declines that are more like 3% or 5%, which will make a giant impact in the outlook for supply. So in the short run, 9 to 10 million barrels a day, no problem. More likely to be a plateau than a significant increase. And if they can manage the production and the amount of money that's flowing back to the wellhead in an intelligent, measured fashion, it's a plateau of 9, 10-ish that can probably be sustained into the next decade. But after that, it will definitely decline, and Russia does not stand ready to increase production to meet the growing level of world demand. So the final summation is Russian production up or down? Probably not either. It's probably at a plateau and may increase some, could decrease some, but isn't in that kind of clutch position that it's been for the last 7 or 8 years, where increases in production actually saved us probably from the earlier incidents of even higher prices that we're seeing today. That's the outlook. That's the analysis. That concludes the talk. Thank you very much.
We have time for some questions, if you like.
Sorry, the question was, what is the fraction, what's the quantity of oil production that comes from the other former Soviet republics, mainly Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, but a small amount from the other ones? And I think the answer to that is between 1.5 to 2-ish, maybe a little over 2-ish now. But it used to be 1, that was the rule. Now, because of what's happened to Tengiz, and what's happening now with the Azeri-Ganeshli-Chirag in Azerbaijan, it's probably getting close to 2.
Second question is, how much oil is used in Russia and how much is exported?
They export roughly 40%, 60% in turn. Yes, sir. Well, the answer to the question is they're doing something that I think is actually real good. They are taking the excise tax revenues for that portion of price that exceeds at the moment $27 a barrel, and it's going into what's called the stabilization fund, which at this point is over $15 billion. And that stabilization fund is being reserved for several very good purposes. One is paying down national debt. And the second is for infrastructure sort of investments. And third, we're seeing some of it go for rehabilitation of basic human services that have been so badly denied in the last 15 years since the Soviet Union fell apart. Well, China, of course, went from a position a number of years ago being a net exporter to a substantial net importer of oil. And Russia has offered to the Chinese, and there has been memoranda of understanding that support the construction of 1 to 2 oil pipelines that are coming out of East Siberia and potentially even out of West Siberia that will feed the Chinese market. There's also a parallel program to move gas from East Siberia to China as well. So Russia sees China as an important and growing market. They see their ability to penetrate the Asian market as a high priority, and they will put, I think, a substantial and sustained investment into getting pipelines that do run east in order to feed not only the Chinese market but the Pacific Rim generally. Was that responsive to your question? Yes, sir.
I think I'll ask the question a little bit like what Dr. Noor's talk was about, namely about the interaction between political power and oil.
Right.
And I am sort of surprised by your comment that perhaps the demise of the Soviet Union might have been the result of the recognition that its oil wasn't growing as fast as it had been. I heard the TV set that brought a Western culture in that people didn't want communism anymore. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the effect of oil on world politics, specifically with the Russian view that I haven't understood, and whether the idea that perhaps the demise of oil growth had a big, huge impact on economic growth, which had an impact on communism's growth.
Yeah, what I meant to say, and I may not have been clear about it, is this, is that their ability to get extremely cheap oil into the economy on a sustained basis, particularly in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, gave them an economic flexibility to endure in a way that they would not have had in its absence. If the Volga Urals had peaked and there had been no West Siberia, and after it peaked in 1976, it had just fallen as it had, and it fell very dramatically after 76 peak, then the Russians would have been forced to reconcile their internal economic system much more closely with the world price of oil than they did. So they actually got an incredible windfall from their oil resources because they were able to sell them on export markets for dollars that they didn't have because the ruble was not a convertible currency. So that gave them an economic flexibility that I think actually allowed the system to endure for longer than it would have. Because while certainly blue jeans and television sets played a role in popular dissent and consumer culture had its influence, it's a little hard for me to imagine that struck as deeply against Soviet economics as the dependency that they had on this lush energy source that they were exploiting. I hope I answered your question. I can tell you pretty definitely they think they weren't. There are some exceptions to that, but even of the ones where I was involved as a consultant, I could do a wallpaper of this entire auditorium with memoranda of understanding that I saw and wasn't a party to, but at least watched them go on. I think the industry would also say that they face a situation not unlike this in many of the places where they operate. So it wasn't so much that it was bad in absolute terms, it wasn't so much bad in relative terms. And there are some projects that have gone forward, Exxon's project on Sakhalin, Shell's project on Sakhalin, and certainly the investment of BP and TNK. Those have been by and large honored, and not without problems, but by and large honored. But while I can point to less than a handful of good examples, ConocoPhillips project and Timan Petro would be another, I could also point to dozens, if not hundreds, of projects that never got off the ground. And it was on both sides. I mean, the Russians thought, in a very large extent, that the Westerners were coming in there to cheat them, and some of the Westerners were going in there to cheat them. Some of them weren't, and there was a lot of honest dealing as well. But it's not one-sided, but there was a lot of disappointment on both sides. Yes, ma'am. The only pipelines, big pipeline projects I know of in that area, other than gas, gas coming out of Turkey essentially, is there is a problem with the Bosporus. A lot of Russia's oil comes out of Black Sea ports and has to go through the Bosporus to the Mediterranean. And the Bosporus is a very kind of dicey place to go through if you're a ship captain and there's a lot of traffic. And so what there is there's talk of running pipelines basically so around the Bosporus so there's not as much tanker traffic. And not only around the Bosporus on the Turkish side, but also to get from the Black Sea to the Adriatic. So I don't think it's as much new pipeline systems coming down from West Siberia like Druzhba does, but it is these circumvention pipelines that are associated with getting out of the problem with the capacity of the Bosporus. I suspect it will. I suspect it will. There's a pipeline now that runs from the Caspian Sea, in essentially at Baku, that goes through Azerbaijan, Georgia, into Turkey, and then comes out at Ceyhan, which is the Turkish port on the Mediterranean. There is a real serious physical constraint associated with the Bosporus, and it is not going to get better. So pipelines appears to be the most reasonable answer for that. Yes, sir? In the back? Yeah. It's a good situation for the service companies, and it's likely to only get better, especially if this continued operation of oil and gas assets by state entities continues. The demand for service company technology, service company management will only grow. Sibneft, which had just been acquired by Gazprom, really was kind of the premier at managing those relationships. Yukos did it very well, too. They have a lot to offer. There are Russian service companies that have a whole lot to offer as well, and that is really kind of one of the unsung stories of Russian oil industry in the last 10 years is the growth of the service industry in Russia. The IPO of the initial public offering by Rosneft is, well, you know, at one level, it makes a lot of sense. You can kind of make sense to go buy the stuff because it's so undervalued with respect to what an equivalent IPO of a Western oil company would be. Western oil companies are capitalized generally in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 per barrel of proved reserves. Russian oil companies are capitalized $3, $5-ish, so there's a big multiple there. The other side of the coin is it's a state entity. It's certainly not, in my view, going to be governed, even if they putatively sell 49% of the shares to the public. It is not going to be governed by the best interests of those common stockholders. It's going to be a state entity, and it's going to act like a state entity. Yes, sir? Bob?
Does your prediction for the overall future of Russian production profile take into account the possible growth in East Siberia?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, East Siberia will grow, and in the next decade, it's going to be very important. It's not going to be important for a number of years because you don't have pipe. But there are considerable fields. There's a half a dozen fields that are billion barrels or over in East Siberia. But as a matter of geology, East Siberia is in no sense as prospective as West Siberia because there's a tremendous amount of East Siberia, which is igneous and metamorphic rock, or it's covered by volcanics, and it is not the kind of rich sedimentary basin that you see in West Siberia that formed over a tremendous area. So an important province, it will make contributions, it will feed the Pacific market, those are all important things, but will it be enough to actually make a nice level of decline, which would be fairly low, turn around and actually go up? Probably not. It just doesn't have the geologic resource base to do that. Yes, sir, in back. You're getting more into politics than I normally follow, but what I do know is this, that there are two people, curiously, that I've heard mentioned repeatedly as being a successor. One is actually Bogdanov, the guy who's chairman of Sorgutneftegaz. And Sorgutneftegaz is absolutely the most insular of all Russian major companies. And Bogdanov, you know, Bogdanov still goes by the title of Director General, which was his old Soviet title. And he's an older guy, and the thought is there that he's going to come in from 2008 to 2012 as a caretaker, basically operating under Putin's control. And then in 2012, Putin won't be constrained by the constitutional limit on two successive terms. Putin comes back into office. The other one that you hear about is Medvedev, who is one of his chief counselors and is now a luminary within Gazprom. He's a young man, a very energetic and active man, but as far as I know, very much of Putin's mind as to the role of oil and gas and the role of markets in the Russian economy. So if Medvedev comes in, Medvedev is not likely to be a caretaker, but I suspect is rather likely to follow the same sort of path that Putin's already established.
How popular is Putin's model amongst people in the gas industry?
Well, it's real popular among the state-run ones. I mean, they've made out really, really well. As far as private companies, you know, you get in line. It's kind of like getting back into the Soviet period. Alek Perov, the chairman of Lukoil, when asked why he was successful and Khodorkovsky is in jail, he said, "We understand our limits." And if you understand your limits, you do fine. And if you go outside those limits, you better be packed because you're going somewhere. Either you're leaving the country or you're on your way to jail. It is a fairly intolerant regime with respect to overt opposition. Not that there can't be different points of view and not that there can't be a market that's successful, but I think it has to come within the confines of the framework that the current administration has set up. Yes, sir. Yeah, the pipeline system is state-controlled, an organization called Transneft, and they are putting a lot of money, actually. There was a 10% increase in tariffs this year as a result of the capital requirements of building new pipelines, including the one to China, specifically. That was used as justification for the increase in tariffs. Building a pipeline like that, once it gets underway, is a several-year operation because of its length and complexity. There have also been increases in pipeline capacity. Baltic system that comes out of Timon Petrora now delivers to the Black Sea. There's been a lot of work in rehabilitation. So they are paying attention to that, understanding that it is a serious constraint. Actually, because of the constraint, a fair amount of oil is actually moving by rail now, much more than used to move, and it's more expensive to move it by rail. All of China exports have to move by rail, for instance. It's expensive.
I read at one point that Russia wastes more oil per day than America actually produces just from the state of the infrastructure so lavishly at this point. I don't know if there's any truth to that, but I was wondering if you could maybe speak a little bit to the state of infrastructure, like these pipelines that we're talking about, and that sort of thing.
On an empirical level, it's highly hyperbolic. Russia is producing 9.4 million barrels a day. America produces a little bit less than that if you count condensate production as well. There definitely is problems in West Siberia and the Volga-Ural basins with the leakage of oil from gathering systems, and a lot of effort has gone in both of those basins to rehabilitate those, not only from the point of view of efficiency, because they're getting real money for it now as opposed to in the Soviet period, but actually some rudimentary level of environmental concern as well. And I would call it only rudimentary. But to state that it's millions of barrels a day or something like that is way hyperbolic. I would be very reluctant to try and put a number on it. Surely it's greater than thousands. Is it tens of thousands of barrels a day? I'm sure it's in the neighborhood of thousands anyway. And it isn't just the pipeline gathering systems. The wells themselves often lack integrity in terms of casing programs and things like that. So you've got a leaky system. There's no doubt about that. And it's a leaky system in gas, too. You've got methane that's venting directly in the atmosphere, doing no one any good. Increasing amount of investment has gone to repair those. World Bank projects, EBRD type projects have gone into replacement. Really, the problem is in the fields. It isn't with the mainline pipelines that are 48 or 56 inch lines that go from West Siberia to Europe. The problem is in the 6-inch lines and the 8-inch lines that go from a well to a gas oil separation unit in the middle of a field or something.
We need to draw it to a close there. I'd like to have you join me. Thank John Grace once again. I'd also like to... Also like to thank Warren Court, who helped us put the lecture together, and also Laura Garner, who's put up all the nice posters and done all of the arrangements. So thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.